It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. A report card released yesterday by the Allegheny Conference on Community Development indicated business investment in our 10-county region hit a 12-year high. We're going to talk about what is spurring that investment and whether it's translating to jobs with Jim Futrell. He's Vice President of Market Research and Analysis for the Allegheny Conference. Jim, welcome to the confluence.
Good morning. Great to be here.
Jim, I mentioned the highest mark in a dozen years. That takes us back to pre-Great Recession. About how much money, though, are we talking about in the investment?
Well, what we've seen is that we can continually see at least $1 billion in investment announced for the region. This year was the seventh consecutive year that more than $2 billion has been announced, and it was roughly $3.7 billion in development projects announced through the region.
Mm-hmm. So, are these numbers indicating that the region has made a complete recovery from the recession that I alluded to?
Well, we have recovered the jobs. One of the things about this report card is, while it's not a scientific sampling, we have noticed over the years that it's a really good indicator of what's going on in the economy. So, during the Great Recession, you did see a drop off in announcements. And then coming out of the Great Recession, you saw how energy was really driving the recovery. And what we've seen in the last couple of years is a real big increase in IT and robotics announcements. So we have seen it how it reflects the broader regional economy.
Well, the report does look at five strategic sectors, including the IT and robotics, as well as manufacturing, healthcare and life sciences, financial and business services, and energy, which you alluded to. So it's IT and robotics that's standing out. Any other one that you want to draw our attention to, though?
Well, I think one of the ones that might surprise a lot of people is the level of activity in manufacturing.
That used to be a core sector for this region.
And it really still is. But it's really kind of changed and evolved over time. So, I mean, I think a lot of people are surprised to see that it is one of the most active sectors in terms of announcements. Last year, there were 56 manufacturing announcements we identified. That was actually up from 51 the year before. But the whole nature of manufacturing has changed. It's no longer the really large manufacturing plants that employ thousands of individuals. Those types of facilities now tend to be very highly automated using a highly skilled workforce. So there are not as many people. But what we are seeing tend to be smaller scale announcements, a few dozen jobs. But it also tends to be higher technology manufacturing and with a higher skilled workforce.
So is it a different way of making things, or are we making different things?
Still a lot of our historic strengths in, you know, metals and materials. But yeah, it's a different way of making it, highly automated and highly skilled.
We mentioned the five sectors. Are there any that are lagging behind, or would they be on another list?
Well, those would kind of be another list. These five sectors are the ones that we have seen continually drive the regional economy. They're the ones that tend to have the higher paying jobs, the more skilled jobs, the family-sustaining jobs. So those are the ones we tend to focus on in economic development, the ones we identify for recruitment into the region.
Right. Healthcare, it made a huge dent, I believe, in 2017. Investments from UPMC, AHN, St. Clair combined for, I believe it was $3 billion, more than half of the region's $5.5 billion promised that year. Is there concern about a drop-off, though?
No, one of the things about this scorecard is these are announcements of planned activities in many instances. So we, in 2016, we had over $10 billion in announced investment, but $6 billion of that $10 billion was the Shell cracker. So that's a project that is ongoing now. This year will be the peak construction year for that project, but it's still another 2 or 3 years out from actually being a fully productive facility. In the case of the healthcare, those were also announced last year, roughly $3 billion, and but those are also projects that are now ongoing and will unfold over the next decade.
When you say last year, are you referring to 17 versus 18, which is the new report card that you just
released? So, 2017, they made the announcement, but they tend to be long-term projects.
Your report, and you've used the term announcements in our conversation, talks about business announcements, site visits as an indicator of success. They also count media reports and press releases. But do announcements give an accurate assessment of actual dollars invested and the jobs created?
Well, again, I'll emphasize this is not a scientific study. It's a compilation of public announcements. We view these as very strong leading indicators of what's going on in the economy. A company is not going to make an announcement to add jobs or build a new building or expand an existing business if they don't have confidence in the economic conditions going forward.
I assume you don't just look inward, you look outside the region. So how are we doing compared to other cities, competitor locations?
We have a set of 15 benchmark cities that we compare ourselves against. It's a combination of cities that most resemble us economically, cities that we want to aspire to be like in terms of growth and economic mix, and ones that we compete with. And, you know, last year, employment increased in the region 1.1%, which was actually the best performance employment-wise since 2012. And I think you saw that again reflected in the scorecard as we saw an increase in announcements. It fell slightly behind the U.S. average. The U.S. average was about 1.7%. But among our peer benchmark regions, we were very competitive. We actually, four of the five, we performed better than.
And the frequent competitors, as they're called, the ones are Baltimore, Charlotte, Indianapolis, Philadelphia, and Nashville. And the pure comparison is Cincy, Cleveland, St. Louis, Detroit, Milwaukee. Who do you aspire to compete with?
Those are cities throughout the country. They have,
Boston's, et cetera?
Yeah, so like Austin, Boston, Denver, Minneapolis, Seattle.
Mm-hmm. We have just a couple minutes left. I want to ask you, how did the Amazon HQ2 competition affect us?
Well, in a number of different ways. One of the things that really benefited the region is it provided the impetus for a lot of the people involved in economic development to come together. Dozens of people from many organizations came together to help put together the proposal. And I think it showed us how we can work together to attract some of these big projects. It also, by sheer virtue of us making the finalist list, really caused a lot of businesses to take a look at us in a different light. We were put in that same competitive set with, Austin, Boston, Denver were all on the finalist list. So a lot of our aspirational communities were considered among the finalists for Amazon. So we have seen ourselves get on more expansions list just by virtue of being named a finalist.
So a no from Amazon wasn't necessarily a negative?
No. Any publicity is good publicity. And I think the national publicity we got about being viewed as one of the 20 cities out of the 239 proposals submitted that Amazon thought could accommodate their expansion really caused a lot of entities to look at us in a different light.
The report released yesterday that we're referring to indicated that one impediment to further growth is corporate taxes. Pennsylvania having one of the highest corporate income tax rates. I believe it's second highest at 9.9%. But what do you say to the average person who says, I'm paying more than my fair share in personal income tax, sales tax, property taxes, businesses should do as well?
That's perfectly agreeable. But I think we have to find a way to bring that down, maybe not necessarily burden the individual taxpayer, but look at other ways to accommodate that. I mean, just a couple percentage point reduction in the corporate net income tax at a state level will make us much more competitive because when companies are screening, one of the first things they do is look at some of these very easy indicators. So when you have a tax rate of 9.99%, that might knock a lot of people off the list immediately before they even start to inquire, and we can kind of work them through the process about it might not be your full tax bill.
And my final question for you is, the numbers we've been talking about are from last year, 2018. Any early indicators about 2019?
Well, I know we have a pretty full book. We are working on 111 active projects right now. So we are seeing a pretty good start to the year. I think you're going to see a big run up in construction jobs this year. Again, the investments we've talked about are really kind of getting into full speed development. So,
Jim Futrell is the Vice President of Market Research and Analysis for the Allegheny Conference on Community Development. Jim, thanks so much for making the time.
Certainly. Have a great day.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Quick quiz. Braddock Borough is named for, of course, General Edward Braddock, a British general from the mid-18th century in colonial America. This weekend, the Braddock Battlefield History Center reopens with refurbished and updated exhibits. Erica Knuckles is the center's director of history and collections. Welcome to The Confluence.
Thanks for having me, Kevin.
All right, so 264 years ago, the Battle of the Monongahela during the French and Indian War, how did that shape the region we live in today?
Well, the Battle of the Monongahela was fought between Great Britain and France, and also a large contingent of Native American warriors that were allied with the French, because both Great Britain and France wanted where Pittsburgh is today. It was a crucial piece of land because of the three rivers. If you controlled those waterways, you could control trade and land for thousands of miles.
And of course, this was a defeat for Colonel George Washington under the command of General Braddock.
Yes, and George Washington was actually involved in the war before Braddock even came over. He was unsuccessful, along with a lot of the colonial provincials, in trying to expel the French from the Ohio River Valley.
So how does the Braddock Battlefield History Center help remind us of that legacy?
Well, first of all, it's located on the battlefield. It's located on the site of the first clash of the Battle of the Monongahela. And it really helps us tell the story of how the battle that happened there on July 9th, 1755, actually sparked the First World War, the Seven Years' War, which eventually would lead to Great Debt in Great Britain, which would lead to our own American Revolution.
Let's talk a little bit about the collections. Any really cool pieces of history that haven't been seen or talked about much? And maybe even your favorite piece.
Well, we actually have a new piece in the collection. It's a miniature of Lieutenant Milbourne West, who was wounded at the Battle of the Monongahela. We also have a manuscript by Captain Dumas, who took over command after the original leader, Beaujeu, was killed early in the battle.
The French leader.
Yes. And we also brought down from Fort Ligonier a 6-pounder brass cannon. It's a reproduction, but the artillery played an important role in the battle as well.
The center reopening this weekend. Why did it close?
So it just closed for a few months. The museum was actually started by a man named Robert Messner, who is a wonderful historian. He's a retired lawyer who felt it was really important to share that history where it had happened. He started the museum out of the Braddock Carnegie Library, and then in 2012, he moved it to its current location. He is 80 years old and is ready to pass it on. So he approached Fort Ligonier and our staff there, and we accepted stewardship on December 28th, and we have just been working to freshen up the exhibits, get it ready to go, and we have big plans for the future for the museum as well.
All right, we have a lot of French and Indian War sites in the Pittsburgh area. So we have Fort Necessity, Fort Pitt, for example. Does the History Center see itself, you know, sort of part of a collaborative work with those sites in the future?
Absolutely. We all work together very much so, because we are telling the same story. We love to promote each other. And the Braddock's Battlefield History Center actually is a place that really connects all of those sites together.
And people tour these different sites, don't they? They make it sort of an adventure, if you would.
Absolutely. There's quite the French and Indian War trail that you can take. And there's nothing cooler than walking where history actually happened. And it happened all around us here in the Pittsburgh region.
All right. You are not just the center's director of history and collections. You are really involved in this. I have to briefly ask, you are a reenactor.
I am. I started reenacting in 1985 at the age of 2.5 with my
what
family.
What did you do as 2.5?
So it's, you know, not super surprising. I work at historic sites associated with the French and Indian War. I grew up doing reenactments as a female camp follower. And just last year, I also took up arms as a man, as a French Marine.
Are you going to do that again?
I hope to, but it's going to be a little while because my uniform is currently on one of the new mannequins at the new center.
Okay. In our last 30 seconds or so, what do your plans look like in the coming year?
So this coming year, we're just looking forward to inviting visitors. We're open Saturdays, Sundays, and Mondays. And also the week of July 6th through the 15th, we'll have a big event on July 9th, which is the 264th anniversary of the battle. And we also hope to, in the next few years, continue improving the museum and the 3-acre lot of that original battlefield.
Dr. Erica Knuckles is the Director of History and Collections at Braddock's Battlefield History Center that's reopening this weekend. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski, still ahead on The Confluence. What do you get when you mix noise rock royalty and the silent films of Andy Warhol? A new exhibit at the Pop Art Icons Northside Museum features work from Sonic Youth's Kim Gordon and includes a brand new score for Warhol's film Kiss. Robots as Trusted Friends. It sounds like the plot of a sci-fi movie, but a new theatrical production of a play takes a look at what holographic companions could mean for grief. Are we too far off from this in real life? To find conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence, check out our website at wesa.fm/confluence.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. The number of ticks carrying Lyme disease in Pennsylvania is increasing. A new Penn State study looked at more than 100 years of tick samples and found the shift has been caused by reforesting. For the past 2 decades, Pennsylvania has one of the highest number of Lyme disease cases in the U.S. And a massive water main break earlier this week had part of the Strip District looking more like a place to dock a boat than park a car. Water has since been restored and crews are working to fix the damage from the 36-inch main. Find more top stories on our website at wesa.fm.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Last week, the Andy Warhol Museum began a year-long celebration of its 25th anniversary, as well as the opening of a new exhibit of work from artist and musician Kim Gordon, including an improvised score for Warhol's silent film Kiss, putting a new spin on Warhol's multimedia concept. WYEP's Brian Swarick explains.
Adding music to the silent films of Andy Warhol is nothing new. In the 1960s, Warhol himself organized multimedia events with musicians like avant-garde composer Lamont Young, and later with a band most closely associated with Warhol, the Velvet Underground, in an experience called the Exploding Plastic Inevitable. Ben Harrison, the Warhol's curator of performing arts, says that the museum is continuing on Warhol's original concept for his films.
In my mind, he created them for multi-purpose use. You know, I mean, he utilized so many of his films in Exploding Plastic Inevitable, from the screen test to Kiss, Sleep. I mean, he would take segments of those films and use them as textural treatment. In this kind of multimedia rock show before that was a thing. So I think that gives us a really clear precedent to kind of continue in that spirit.
In 1994, in the museum's inaugural year, John Cale of the Velvet Underground composed his own soundtrack to the films Kiss and Eat. and performed it at the museum with other members of the group. Last week, the Warhol Museum debuted a new exhibit of the work of Kim Gordon, best known as a founding member of the experimental rock group Sonic Youth. When you enter the exhibit, the sound of Gordon's commissioned soundtrack to Kiss begins subtly and then gets louder as visitors get closer to the area where the film is screened along with the music. Jessica Beck, the Warhol's Milton Fine curator of art, says the bleeding of the soundtrack throughout the exhibit was planned.
Yeah, it was really important from the beginning not to silo the sound in the exhibition design. So I worked with Ben to come up with a way to make the sonic element present and to have it permeate the floor plan. It's all blended then into the exhibition because the sound isn't pushed to a back room with a door. It's really allowed to breathe and to live and to vibrate in the exhibition.
Kim Gordon is the most recent of many contemporary musicians to add their sound to the artist's silent films. In the past, the museum has commissioned them for shorter films, like Warhol's Screen Tests. But Gordon explains that she chose Kiss because she wanted more room.
I wanted to pick a film that was an hour long because the previous projects had been with 5-minute screen tests and were song-based. So I suggested we approach it from an improv point of view, and it made just more sense to choose something longer.
Kim Gordon, along with collaborators Bill Nace, Steve Gunn, and John Trzynski, recorded the soundtrack last year in the Warhol Museum's theater and played it live again for the exhibition's opening. And she says the improv work went through some evolution.
Well, we had a kind of a strategy. I mean, originally, the way I thought we would do it, we ended up not doing it. It just seemed more organic. You know, originally, it was going to be Steve and John for 20 minutes, and then me and Bill overlapping, and then me and Bill. But it just kind of made more sense not to do it so formally.
Ben Harrison says that Gordon's soundtrack sheds a new light on Warhol's film.
I talk about it in these terms of kind of being the strange duality of the film and her soundtrack. Those dualities being like eroticism and repulsion, passivity and aggressive. You know, it's very physical, almost like abstract. You know, it's the way the couples are kissing and interacting that it's, you know, it has this voyeuristic element, but it also is kind of off-putting. And I think that Kim's soundtrack just kind of brings those things out, but it also adds this kind of aggression to that film, this kind of haunting quality.
Instead of issuing an exhibition catalog, the museum has pressed a double vinyl record of the soundtrack. The record itself was mastered under Gordon's supervision and with a sound in mind.
As I was mixing it with the engineer, Aaron Mullen, I wanted it to actually have the sound of a Velvet Underground record, of one of those early records. So what we did is we, after we'd got the edit of things, because we'd played it a few times and mixed it, we then sent it through two amplifiers and mic'd the amps, and so it has this really kind of nice, warm, thick sound that reminds me of the Velvet Underground.
Kim Gordon Lo-Fi Glamour is on view at the Andy Warhol Museum until September 1st. For The Confluence, I'm Brian Sawarek.
And I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. You lose a loved one, but can't let go. So mix artificial intelligence, some other technology, and create a holographic replacement. The idea comes to life on the stage at Pittsburgh Public Theater as it presents Jordan Harrison's play Marjorie Prime. Joining us in studio is one of the leads in the production, actor Ben Blazer, and we invited back to the program Ila Norbash, professor of ethics and computational technologies in the Robotics Institute at Carnegie Mellon University. Welcome to The Confluence, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Ben, I'm going to start with you. You play Walter Prime. What is a prime?
A prime. So in our play, which begins in the year 2062, approximately. There's a group called Senior Serenity that exists, and they provide for people that have lost a loved one an AI program in the form of a chatbot. So we're holographic chatbots,
okay,
basically.
Now, Ill, I have to ask you. Now, he said 2062, so that's going to – is. Could it happen by then? Could it happen before then? I mean, is the premise of the play, that's just too way out or not too far off?
You know, it's funny. The hardest part about the idea of robots amongst us is the mechanics of them, the gears and motors. But making this a hologram makes it much more possible. And frankly, I have kids that chat with Siri. So the idea of a chatbot that can have a half-intelligent conversation with a person is here. And it's just going to get better. Every single year, these systems get more sophisticated, and they are able to embody more of what we consider to be the province of humans.
In the play, Senior Serenity, Serenity is the company that manufactures.
That's correct.
The holographic person made as a companion for someone who's lost a family member. Ben, you are, well, at least your role is a holographic companion. How do you know the decades of memories, of life experiences of the man that you are replacing?
That's a great question, and it's a bit tough to answer with this play because of the nature of how it's written. It's focused pretty immediately, and there isn't a ton of information. The majority of the information about Walter and his life with Marjorie, who is the other character in the play, comes from her and her memories, which are fragmented, and they're also not dependable. So I investigated that a lot. I was looking for a lot of information, and of course, with Mariah's guidance, I've kind of discovered that wasn't the most important focal point to enter the play for my character, because I never play a human. I'm the only character in the play that never plays a human. You meet me as a prime, and that's how I finish. So my focus became a lot more on the technology and to inform me as to how I operate within the play.
Does the company sort of input some memories, some feelings, whatever?
I actually am not sure. Our inference is that when a family receives a prime, they're a pretty clean slate. We're pretty neutral, and we only know what we're told. We learn by chatting with the whole family. So false information can also be introduced for a variety of reasons.
Well, what about the technology? Is that possible to sort of input memories and emotions or whatever?
You know, the interesting thing about the lives we lead today is that we have this incredibly vast digital footprint. All the text messages we've ever written, every email we have, videos online on YouTube and elsewhere. In fact, there's movies that play with that where you fill in a prime-like alien robot by having it surf the web and learn everything about your behavior. Huh. What's interesting about that case and about the case that Ben's playing is that there's a disconnect between the real you, the whole you, and this fractional, partial version of you. If I was to scrape just Kevin and everything about Kevin on the internet, I don't get Kevin. I get this strange shadow of you.
Of course, Marjorie Prime is directed by Mariah C. Kambinski,
yes.
And it opens May 30th.
May 30th through June 30th, yes, sir.
Ila, you've been studying interactions between humans and robots for many years now. So as the robotics, as the IA expert in this room, will that be possible, all of this that we're talking about?
It will eventually be possible, yes. And that's what's kind of scary and titillating and interesting about this. We occupy a space in robotics where we try and create authentic social interactions, in many cases, between people and robots by using human social cues in robots. So we have robots smile and get sad and giggle and laugh. And it opens up this vast challenge because we're using human-like signals to manipulate how you respond emotionally to a robot. But we're getting better and better at that. That's how we sell you stuff on the internet. It's called behavioral analytics. Of course, that could also make you, happy at home because you feel like your loved one's closer than they actually are. And that's a tricky space to be in.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. We're talking with Ben Blazer, who's starring in the Public Theater's production of Marjorie Prime, play about a holographic replacement for a now departed loved one. Also in studio is Eleanor Bash from CMU's Robotics Institute. So, Ben, you are playing a holograph, we've just established that, to replace Marjorie's departed loved one, Walter. I wonder, how are you doing it, in a sense? Are you doing it as a, you know, as the holograph was, as if it was real? Is there some sort of you living human character to it? Or is it sort of mechanical, robotic, computer-like edge to it?
Great question. If I can speak for Mariah, she's not here, but of course we're in the room together working on this. I think one of the things we're going for is to allow everyone to be fooled. In the writing, there are a few specific pieces of dialogue that are meant to draw us out of the illusion that we're lulled into. So less robotic, more neutrality and a placidness, but full of life in terms of the chatting aspect. So there's a lot of mirroring, a lot of reflecting based on what our partner is showing us,
right?
You know, whether they're enjoying the story I'm telling them, whether I'm reminding them of something uncomfortable, whether it's eating peanut butter or the fact that it's shower day or something like that.
Right. So, Eli, I want to you pick up on what Ben was saying, that chatting. What do you project at some time in the future that interaction to be like?
So there's actually a system from the 1970s that started this whole direction. It was called ELIZA. The way it fooled people and the way it engaged with you is where we're headed, which is that it reflected back to you. So you'd ask a question of ELIZA or you'd make a statement, and it would take the words in your statement and push them right back to you. If you mentioned your mother, it would respond with, how do you feel about your mother? And by building constantly on what you say, it seems and it appears to be completely focused on you. It's so in touch with you. It's so empathetic because it's constantly about you. It's never changing the subject very much.
But is it adding, will it be adding anything beyond that reflection, do you see?
To some degree, I think that there's memory and there's command. And there's the only two ways we can imagine adding. On the memory side, you can imagine asking it to tell you a story. Tell me about the time we went on that canoe and it turned over. On the command side, what's the weather going to be like tomorrow? Give me a forecast and find a recipe for me and order the right raw ingredients from Whole Foods.
I want both of you to chime in on this. And that is, it seems like the play is meant to be more than a sci-fi fantasy. There are elements of humor and emotion in it as well, are there not, Ben?
Yes, I think it's very funny. It's very warm. And Mariah is committed to having a play that deals with tech in part of each of her seasons, if I'm understanding her mission correctly. And this is the play about tech this year, but it's really about human beings. It's really about family. It's very much about memory.
Memory, I think, is this critical part of this. I mean, what's really fascinating about this play is it's about the question of memory and the question of authenticity. What does it mean to be faked out by a robot and even to be willing to be faked out by a robot? Does that make it okay? Does it make it okay for me to project my love of a lost one onto a robot because that makes me feel better? Or is that somehow inauthentic? And of course, the robot is actually in some ways better and different from the lost one. It doesn't age. It doesn't die. It can't go away. So it's a really interesting question that as technology gives us this capacity to love, to care, and to have memories, is it okay if they're fake?
Well, you just mentioned doesn't age. And Ben, you are playing the younger version of Walter.
Yes, yes.
Whereas Marjorie is
she's 86 in the play. And I was cast as a 30-year-old.
Pardon the pun, you are in your prime.
I am definitely in my prime as compared to Marjorie, yes. Possibly pun intended there. You know, on the subject of authenticity, you just made me think now, Ela, what we do as actors sometimes feels like that as well. You know, we'll have people approach us and tell us about their experiences watching us. And of course, it isn't us, but for them, it's quite authentic. Even when people interpret a play and they tell us what they thought it was, even if we've said something different, I say, well, that's what it was for you. But there's an echo in the play about how real they look and how easily you can be fooled. And John, one of our actors, Nathan Hinton, he has the line, he says, well, it helps that we want to believe. And there's a parallel to theater there as well. And, you know, there's a lot of it on the consumer as well.
That's right.
If you agree.
It, is there a boundary, though? Is there a boundary between deception, if you would, authenticity, and even manipulation?
Absolutely. That's what I call ethics. And that's the challenge that we face. Our technologists, they're not, they haven't done improv. They haven't done acting. They haven't thought about the whole idea of inauthenticity or authenticity and when it's okay to be inauthentic and when it isn't. So we have an entire gang of engineers in our world who can invent systems that are ever more convincing, more manipulative, and they don't have a sense of where that boundary is. I'm convinced there's a boundary, and I'm also convinced we have no regulatory rules or even social constructs around where the boundary should be.
Hmm. Sunday, June 2nd, Illa, you will be participating in a discussion with Mariah C. Kaminsky, the director of this production. It's called When Robots Become Our Companions, Facts, Fantasies, and Uncomfortable Truths. The title said when become our companions, not if.
I think that's right. I think they're already on the way of becoming our companions. In our real world, our smartphones are in our pockets all the time. They're essentially a mini version of companionship already.
So to both of you, isn't it sort of a major leap from robots and holograms in this case, assisting us to being our companions? Is that one of the uncomfortable truths? Ben, I'll start with you.
Oh, boy. It certainly can be one of the uncomfortable truths. But I don't know. It's hard for me to project.
You know what scares me about this? Is that that robot that you can be vulnerable towards and you can have feelings towards, it's not just one robot in your building, in your room. It's actually networked. Hmm. Talk about surveillance. Talk about lack of privacy. So we're on this cusp of being and accepting companionship from things that are actually networked and owned by a corporation somewhere. And then you can start wondering, how will they use the information derived from that interaction?
Lack of control there. So something that we might want, we might need, but this corporate entity might be able to use that information.
That's right.
Yeah, we've theorized about proprietary rights from the present into the future, because we have a scene in the play that takes place far into the future. And we've theorized about that a lot in terms of what we're allowed to learn from one another and at what point in history, you know.
Ben, as an actor, I want to get your answer briefly. How has it helped you in this role to get to know somebody like Illa?
Oh, my gosh. Well, the great thing about acting is you're, and for lack of a better term, you're forced to research areas that you're of subject matter that your play deals with. And it's led me to so many different areas that either because of a lack of awareness or a lack of time or whatever, you're forced to focus on. And I told Eli, I was watching videos and, talks of his. So it's fascinating. I wish we could talk more, because I actually know very little about how AI actually works. And I shouldn't admit that playing a character, but I would certainly be at the talk. You know, I can guarantee that.
Okay. We have less than a minute left. So I want to ask both of you, what should be our takeaway from seeing Marjorie Prime? Briefly, Illa.
I think it's a glimpse of the future. I think we should look at that play and think about how it makes us feel emotionally, and then think about what role we can play in creating and guiding the right future. We have to be citizens, and we have to help decide what role we want robots to play in our personal lives.
And Ben, people come and see you and your cohorts.
I agree. I think it's a very provocative play, and the goal is that they'll be leaving thinking. They'll be leaving with maybe an interest to learn more and take some agency as well. And to quote Mariah, I believe she said, "My hope is also that people call their mothers at the end of the play, you know, because it is so much about family and creating the memories now."
Actor Ben Blazer is starring in the Pittsburgh Public Theater's production of Marjorie Prime, which runs May 30th to June 30th. Mm-hmm. And Illa Norbash is a professor of ethics and computational technologies in the Robotics Institute of Carnegie Mellon University. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you both.
My pleasure.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time on The Confluence, that's Tuesday, a new office of equity is being created in Pittsburgh. We'll discuss how this can address racial and gender inequities. Plus, more and more survivors of sexual assault are coming forward in Amish and Mennonite communities. If you missed anything from today's program, if you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, assistance by Julia Zenkovic and Julia Maruka. The editor and producer of the program is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a great weekend of good news.